There's a fair amount of overcoming of fear to speak such words. On the other hand, they've changed secretaries of energy since then, so maybe it's a good thing. Telephone system cascade failures have caused long-distance service outages, like in 1990. And inter-system cascades, such as power failures, bring down telephone switches required to bring back up the power system. Can also happen. So you can have cross-infrastructure cascades, which are very nasty. And nobody really knows how to analyze this yet. So, you got a candle? No problem. You'll be able to read during the next. You have a book, right? Because you can't read with your computer. Bribes and extortion. We like to change subjects at random here. Promises or threats that cause people to violate their trust. For example, bribing a guard to get entry into a building. More likely, bribing a... And in fact, in the case of bribery, the amount is very important. You laugh. I'm very serious. If you're going to bribe a maintenance man to get into a building, depending on where you are in the country, you don't want to pay more than like $20 or $30 or $40. Okay? If you pay $100 in that bribe, you'll get into the building and he'll report it. If you pay $5, he'll say to shove off. So you have to know the right amount to bribe. And where do you find out the right amount to bribe? Well, you just have to know people in low places. But knowing the right people in the right low places tells you the right amount to bribe. And so you need to, that's the key to most, to many, many crimes, especially information-related crimes, is knowing how much to take. If you take too much, it gets over the threshold and the FBI comes after you. Or if you take too much, it gets over the threshold and they send the hitmen out to get you, or what have you. If you take too little, you're going to do a lot of work and not get much out of it. You know, these guys that did this ATM fraud that ran up and down the East Coast and around, they put in a fake ATM machine and recorded costs. But they figured it cost them like $400,000 to set up the fraud, and they got caught after like $150,000. Okay. Why did they talk about it? There you go. Whatever. So what were the amounts? Cost them four or five, and they brought in $150,000. Not a very good investment. So you know, so you need to steal the right amount. And again, that's the key to being a successful criminal, is you know, knowing how much to steal and when to stop. Same, by the way, as being successful in gambling in Las Vegas. Right? You come in with some small amount of money that you're willing to lose, and usually you lose it. But if you're going to win, I'm up to 10,000. I got to keep going. Well, no. You set a threshold. Once you get to that number, you quit, because eventually the odds will get you. That's the nature of odds. So it's the same. In almost any crime, if you commit it enough, you'll get caught. Oh, I'm sorry, if you commit it too much, I guess. It depends on your perspective. Kidnapping key employee family to gain access to a computer, that works. Using sexually explicit photographs to get insider information works everywhere except against congressmen, because anymore they don't care. Get a job. Now, I realize that to most criminals this is a matter of pride that they wouldn't do this, but professionals, professional thieves and hackers and crackers and other computer criminals will actually go in and get a job to gain insider access and then exploit that. For example, you know, get a maintenance job by underbidding the opponents. Okay? So you underbid somebody. In fact, I bid so it's downright not profitable to get the maintenance contract on this facility. And the way I make up for my lack of profit on my low bid is to come in and steal your information and resell it. And by the way, there's now currently street value on things like executive PCs from Fortune 500 companies, like $10,000, I think, or something, per PC. And it's not because the PC is a particularly good one. It's about the content. Planting spies and intelligence agents in intelligence agencies of competitors. Of course, that never happens in the United States. Almost never. Well, I think maybe... five were caught in the last 6 months of last year. If you look at, you do a media search. So it's not exactly a rare thing. And so getting a job, that's a good idea. Password guessing, you know, you just try them to find a valid authentication sequence, like running a program called Crack that you just get off the internet, just say, search with Alta Vista for crack. It'll give you 50 places, and you just pull one down, load it, and run it against the password file that you steal. Or against the password file on your own system. In fact, if you rename it from crack to crack2, then even if you have a very clever administrator who's looking for programs called crack, they probably won't find it. So just call it X59 or something. They'll never see. Guessing passwords on network routers and PBX switches is very popular. They tend to have relatively easy to guess passwords. They tend to be short, numerical, 4 digits or something like that. Not only that, as a special feature, most of them don't have their audit trails turned on. So they can't tell that you're guessing passwords. You guess them all day. So you just write a program to guess them all, and you get to the router. Well, once you get to the router, everything comes through you. So that's a big win. And then, of course, using well-known maintenance passwords to try to gain entry. Hey, you know, the old tricks are still the best tricks. What's the default password on a Cisco router? Honcho. Okay, now we know. Now everybody knows. If they didn't by now, all they had to do is buy a Cisco router. It's not that hard. Invalid values on calls are used to cause unanticipated behavior. For example, system calls with pointer values leading to unauthorized memory areas still work. I mean, I think I recall that the earliest article I read on this was from the 1962 or something. But you just make a system call and just put in a wrong value for a pointer and see if it doesn't work anyway. So the pointer to the operating system structure is in my memory area. Hey, guess what? I'm in the operating system. Requests for data from databases using system escape characters to cause inter-process communication to operate improperly. Still works. Eight. CGI scripts reintroduced this long-known, long-standing bug, and now those CGI scripts almost universally, there's some sequence of characters you can send them that will give you the ability to take over the server. There it is. Like, for example, the sequence //bin/sh, whatever you want to do, /, is a pretty good one. That works against a lot of them. In most cases, a few hundred well-considered attempts are required to find a successful attack. Then there's the old undocumented or unknown function exploits. For example, Microsoft has made a fortune selling operating systems that have undocumented features, which they then license off to their friendlies as a way to maintain competitive advantage. Backdoors placed in systems to facilitate maintenance access, so they call it maintenance. I think I would call it something else. But undocumented system calls are commonly inserted by vendors to allow special functions for economic or other marketing advantages, and program sequences that are accessible in unusual ways as a result of some improper termination condition. So they leave some data hanging around somewhere that they shouldn't because they didn't think about getting rid of that data, and the next call grabs that data from the wrong place. And yes, sir? This is back to attack 33 here. In general, there's an unlimited number of these things, okay? But depending on the system that you're running, for example, if it's a Unix box, you always want to try all the shell escape characters, okay? So test against all the shell escape characters. Test against, in almost any system nowadays, they use ..slash in their file descriptors. So, for example, try ..slash, 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 etc./password, and see if you get the password file out. This sort of thing. So, what's an example where inter-process communication fails on a database call? You might, for example, open a database, do an open operation, and have it fail and not do a close and end up with an extra file pointer. And if this is done by a system routine rather than a user routine, then that system routine, which is called repeatedly by more and more users, it's like a memory hole, same sort of thing. It now has one less file handle available to it. So you can do that repeatedly and do denial of services to a database, for example. Okay, that's, I mean, if you look, there's just all sorts of flaws in programs. And if you can exploit it this way. Finding backdoors, by the way, this is also true of invalid values on calls, but finding backdoors is in general as hard as demonstrating program correctness. So it's at least NP complete. Exploiting inadequate notice. Now this is a mostly a legal thing where you don't tell somebody they're not allowed in. That, for example, on a website, they come in and you don't have notice, you know, the federally mandated or the state mandated notice. So in New York State, for example, I'm not sure if it's still true, but it used to be there's a law that you can't prosecute somebody for breaking into a system if you didn't notify them when they attempted to break in that they weren't allowed to. Okay? So that's fine if they telnet in and you have some telnet message, but what if they come in on a web port using some web location that you don't have notice on? Okay? Then you don't have notice. They do whatever they do to your system, and they claim this is how I came in, and the audit trail supports that. You can't prosecute them. There's also observation of employee keystrokes without notice, which might result in lawsuits in some states. You know, different states are different on their laws, and different countries are different on their laws. We're in an international environment. For example, if you deal with Singapore, you may find all sorts of problems relating to notice. Password guessing through an interface not providing notice, I mentioned. Web server attacks that bypass any notice provided on the home page. And it's fairly trivial to demonstrate that you're providing notice and to provide the means to provide notice. But it's sort of hard in today's computing environment to do that on every entry. Excess privilege exploitations are fairly common. A program, device, or person is granted privileges not strictly required to do it, and the excess privilege is exploited to gain further access. For example, set UID programs under Unix that are granted root access are exploited to get unlimited access to the attackers because of a flaw in the program. This is, I mean, if you watch the internet, probably there are three or four of these published a month. Recently, more. access to unauthorized need-to-know information by a systems administrator granted to flexible maintenance access to a network router. So, and if you typically, the people that run your network, unless you encrypt all your traffic, have access to a lot of the traffic. And typically, for cost reasons, or because you haven't done the multiplication properly, these people have access to many of the routers, and they can reconfigure things to watch a lot of traffic. So they're exploiting the excess privilege. And then user programmable direct memory access devices. Fairly common, for example, for speech recognition or for high-speed parallel processing pipelines architectures. You can program the DMA device to do special functions. Well, if you reprogram the DMA device to access normally unauthorized parts of memory, you might be able to do a DMA from your program into the operating system and take over the system. So, and so typically any special purpose device that's a DMA device and user programmable is a potential for this. And determining whether a privileged program grants access capabilities looks as hard as proving program correctness. Corrupting the environment. Is this getting too painful to believe? We're only on 37, folks. That's only a third of the way through the attack. So you corrupt the computing environment so the proper operations are corrupted. For example, manipulating their logical and physical and others. In logical, you might change environmental variables, for example, so that the command so that the program that you're running that assumed that space was the command separator now finds that slash is the command separator and interprets information it would normally interpret one way in a completely different way. Goes and grabs information from some file that it has stored that's a protected file, but it's interpreting it differently because you changed the environment in which it interprets. Or setting the path. A program uses the ls command to do something. You set the path so that it comes through your version of ls before the system's version of ls, and you make your own version of ls that does whatever you want to do and then does the regular ls. Sort of typical environmental corruption problems. In the physical domain, you can introduce gases, dust, or other particles or chemicals or whatever into the physical environment. And there's all sorts of things you can do with gases against people, with dust to disrupt services, with particulates to cause crashes. You might induce maintenance, allowing you to then do something that you wouldn't have been able to do if there wasn't a maintenance process going on. In the electromagnetic realm, there are all sorts of things you can do with waveforms. Anybody that's in EW knows lots about this. And then in people, sound, smell, feel, and other sensory input corruption might be induced. So you might make somebody smell something, and I smell gas, and they start looking around for the gas, and they've walked away from their terminal and not locked it up in the normal way because they think they smell gas, for example. There's just all sorts of stuff. The general field of psychology is a subset of information protection. As well as physics and electronics. Device access exploitation. So you access a device and you alter its function or cause its function to be used in unanticipated ways. For example, removing shielding from a wire so it leaks more electromagnetic emanations so you can listen from afar with the Van Eck bugging or something. Well, that'll bring that up later. Reprogramming a bus device to deny services at the hardware level. Altering microcode so to associate attacker-defined functions with otherwise unused operation code. Let's see, there's a way with a Pepsi-Cola can, or you could use a Coke can, or maybe even a Sprite can. I'm not sure whether you can use Sprite, but it depends on the media. A way with a soda pop can that you can take out part of the cable system. So, for example, you have cable television. I can take out cable television in your whole neighborhood without any problem with a Coke can. Don't even need a screwdriver. So there's all sorts of things you can do if you can access physical devices. So since hardware devices in general, at least as complicated as software devices, the complexity of detecting such things is almost certainly NP-complete. Injecting such a flaw seems very simple, on the other hand. So it's pretty easy to launch the attack and pretty hard to figure out that's what's going on. How about modeling mismatches, okay? We use models in systems to figure out, to correspond to realities, to make decisions about reality. And if there's a mismatch between the model and the reality, then that's exploitable. For example, the Bell LePage model is the basis for most of the so-called trusted systems evaluated under the trusted system evaluation criteria, or at least this was true 10 years ago. And as a result, since computer viruses get past things that meet the Bell LePage model, the first systems, so-called trusted systems that were approved, were susceptible very easily to computer viruses because of a modeling mismatch, not because of some error in what they did when they implemented it, but because the model of protection didn't match the model of the attack. Okay, it just, they were incommensurable. Modeling attacks and defenses as if they were statistically independent phenomena is a common thing. Okay? So it ignores synergistic effects. And you use an attack to cause something else to happen, and then that opens up another hole that you exploit. Most of the times that we do analysis, risk analysis and this sort of thing, it ignores those effects. And since you're ignoring those effects, I can exploit them. Modeling misconfigurations of misset protection bits. It's fairly common that we'll check the configuration of a system by checking all the protection bits. But maybe we don't check the contents of all the files that are interpreted by every program in the system. And there's some operating system file that gets read for configuration that has the wrong value set into it. But we think the system is safe because we looked at the wrong thing. So our model of what can go wrong typically doesn't include all the things that can go wrong. There is some theory about this, but there's no general theory, and we're just not that good at it. Simultaneous access exploitations are where two or more simultaneous split multi-part access attempts are made, resulting in a wrong decision. And for example, if you do a lot of access attempts over a short period of time, it's fairly common that the decision software will occasionally make a mistake. All right. For example, because it's run out of file handles. Okay, or because some file is open and locked, but it has to make another decision, and it hasn't implemented that simultaneous access properly. And if it happens that the default is a 0 instead of a 1, it'll make the wrong decision. Okay? The execution of sequences of operations required for system takeover, but done by multiple user identities. Okay, so if I have a known attack, and I'm looking for this specific sequence of commands that does this attack, but instead of running that sequence of commands as one user, the person has two user IDs, does one command as one user, the next command as the next is, and alternates back and forth, my detection software fails. Okay, that's a fairly common. Then holding of a resource required for some other function. You know, you allocate the tape. Now nobody can do backups, right, until they reboot. So now I've prevented you from doing backups. Now if I can do whatever I want to do to your system and then attack it and wipe out everything on it, I can guarantee you didn't have a backup of what went on. Maybe. So it's been analyzed in a cursory fashion, and the number of sequences of events that's possible is generally factorial in the length of the program coexisting in an environment. Okay, factorial in the number of instructions in the programs coexisting in an environment. So if I have 32 megabytes of memory being used by programs, that's 32 million factorial combinations. Oh my goodness, that's too big a multiplier. So we can't fully analyze that one. I don't know what we're going to do about that one. Maybe there's some sort of a partitioning thing. Implied trust exploitation. Programs that operate especially in a shared environment very often trust information that's supplied to them from untrustworthy sources. For example, if you put forged data from domain servers out on the internet, it's very often used to resolve things. And there are at least several cases where you can put out, for example, a few thousand bytes of output from a DNS request, overflow a buffer, and break into a system. Forged replies from authentication daemons are similar, same thing. And in fact, the internet authentication daemon, as used by, I guess it was SendMail in one case, this was the published one, there's the SendMail attack where SendMail goes and uses the ident daemon to identify the remote user. The ident daemon sends over too long a stream. It goes into some other part of SendMail. SendMail uses that as a command string to execute a command as root on the system under attack. So it's trusting remote information to execute root commands. Okay? And of course, network-based administration programs, actually they very commonly now use the World Wide Web, use web browsers to do remote administration. So if you can fool somebody, an administrator's web browser, into sending things out to another port for you, which is a fairly straightforward thing to do with a URL, then you can cause that machine to do administration for you because they trusted that your web server was not going to cause their browser to go do something unauthorized. Am I tricky or what? How about unanticipated or incorrectly handled interrupt sequences? It's fairly common that you don't explore every possible interrupt sequence because that's, again, factorial in the combined length of the programs coexisting in an environment, all the possible sequences of operations that can take place. So stack frame errors are, for example, can be sometimes induced by incorrect interrupt handling. There's at least one case where a swapping daemon was swapped out. It swapped itself out from some unanticipated condition, which means that it couldn't swap itself back in because it wasn't there to do it. This is a fairly old one. And then there's sometimes denial of services resulting from improper prioritization of interrupts. For example, on the internet, it's fairly common for IP packets to have a very high interrupt level on a machine, maybe higher than the disk access. So you can bring down a machine just by sending a lot of IP packets, which have too high an interrupt priority. And in fact, it fills up the highest priority interrupt stack on the machine, and now nothing else can get processed. Keystrokes can't get processed. Disk I.O. can't get processed. Timer interrupts don't get processed, and the system crashes. Emergency procedures are very often put systems and into modes that are far less secure than their normal operating modes. All right, so you induce an emergency condition and wait the results, or you can induce it or you can wait for it. Okay, I mean, ultimately, emergency procedures get invoked because of actual emergencies. You can wait for one or you can cause one. So fires, for example, are emergencies. So if there's a fire, they'll change operations. Everybody rushes out of the building because it's on fire. And people with fireman-looking hats rush into the building. And then those fireman-like people, you know, they have these black stuff all over them and soot and crud and crap, and they walk out, and nobody typically searches them as they leave the building. So that's an easy way, just start a fire. Another one is power failures. And during power failures, after some relatively short period of time, automated alarm and control systems fail, typically into a safe mode with respect to some possibly exploitable criteria. And then incident response. During a computer incident response, administrators typically deviate from normal behavior. If they're responding to a break-in over here that looks real intense, they won't notice password guessing over there because they're all busy. So in most cases, the process that people use to deal with emergencies bypass normal controls. And that makes many attacks feasible during an emergency that are far more difficult not during an emergency. Then we have the whole realm of desynchronization and time-based attacks. And these are particularly nasty because they've been poorly analyzed at best. For example, I mean, here's a time-based attack, year 2K, okay? Nice. How about leap years? And there's just tons of these issues where timing failures cause system failures. Another one is there's an example of DCE servers that deny services when they're desynchronized beyond some threshold. So if the master server gets desynchronized from a client server beyond some threshold of synchronization, the master shuts down and will not start up in this particular implementation, will not start again until the vendor shows up and fixes it. Okay? Okay, now, think about how you're going to attack this. How do you create desynchronization? All right. Cryptographic systems that depend on synchronized encryption and decryption. Okay? It's fairly trivial to desynchronize. All you need to do is insert a bit every once in a while. Doesn't take much energy to insert a bit every once in a while. Insert a bit every once in a while, and those crypto systems get out of sync. Now, there are different ways that they resync. Some are automatic resync. Some are push a button to resync. Okay, how many times is this guy in the control center going to push this button before his finger wears out, and he just says, I'm not going to resynchronize the crypto system ever again. I'm turning off crypto. Forget it. It's not worth it. Well, the answer is there's actually a number of times. For an average trained, you know, person of such and such skill and knowledge, there is an average number of times that they'll push that button before they won't push that reset button anymore. Software that makes complex decisions based on slight time differences. For example, the make facility, now commonly used in C programs, that figures out what to recompile out of a very large complex system depending on modification time. Okay, if I can alter a modification time, I can cause the new version of this not to be compiled. It'll use the old version of this with a new version of that. And guess what? Well, when we debug them, very often we find that that's a problem. But if you, in your debugging, you didn't happen to find it, then I might find it in my attack instead. And then there are, of course, time-based locks that might be caused to open or close at the wrong time. Right? All sorts of time-based locks. If I can speed up time, I can cause you to disable a function or enable a function earlier, or if I can slow down time later, that would be normal. For example, on explosive devices, it's a fairly common trick. You know, cold slows down clocks in a lot of cases. So you've probably even seen it in the movies. An explosive device with a timer, and the electronic circuits, when it hits some condition, the electronic circuits are going to cause it to blow up. So you get some Freon spray or some freeze gas, you know, and you freeze it down, make it real cold, and instead of exploding in a tenth of a second, it explodes in 5 seconds. And that means that you can now get out of the chair and get out of the room before the damn thing blows up. Okay? So that's, but it can be exploited for other things. Imperfect daemons. Daemon programs are designed to provide privileged services on request And those programs very often have imperfections. In fact, essentially every program always has imperfections if it's larger than 80 lines or so. Is it getting cold in here? There you go, it'll warm right up. Improper locks. Right, that's an information system, right? It is, okay. So let's see. Imperfect daemons, so almost every program that's out in the world today as a server has imperfections in it. And if you can find the imperfection, you can exploit it. And to give you a sense of this, we did testing on daemons used in some environments, and on the average, once every 4 hours, if you're looking at gray box testing, on the average, once every 4 hours, you can find a hole that lets you get root access on the server. Okay? And I mean, I'm not the greatest tester or theoretician in the world either. I mean, I just sort of look at the thing and say, gee, what happens if I put a back quote here? What if I put a semicolon here? What if the input's more than 5,000? Didn't seem to check that one. And like that. Let's see. So web gopher, sendmail, FTPT, FTP, and almost every other server daemon that's out there has been at one point or another exploited to give access. Internal use only daemons, like the Unix cron facility, are very commonly exploited to gain root privileges. And automated backup and recovery daemons have been exploited to overwrite current versions of programs with previous ones, et cetera, et cetera. In general, this is at least as complicated as proving program correctness. I say at least, it's actually certainly more, but that usually people say, well, we're never going to do that, so I won't have to bother telling you how bad it really is. Multiple error inducement, you introduce more than one error simultaneously, and it turns out even the most reliable systems around, if you induce more than one error at a time, fail at a very high rate. And there's a study, I think it's cited somewhere else in here. I think it was Leipen published it, where it was an IEEE, and he looked at double error conditions, and almost everything fails under double error conditions. So all you have to do is induce two errors at once. For example, create an input syntax error along with a previously locked error log file, which results in an inconsistent data state. Or a premature termination of a protocol during an error recovery process. Oops. Might cause cascade failures. In fact, there's at least a couple of examples where you can cascade down a whole phone system with this. Then introduction of simultaneous interleaved attack sequences causing normal detection methods to fail. This is, the same thing as that two-user. You can do it in other ways. There's a little bit of work on this. The little amount of work that says that things are pretty bad. Almost every system fails under double error conditions. You've probably all heard of computer viruses, programs that reproduce and possibly evolve. Examples include 11,000 or so known viruses, custom file viruses designed to act against specific targets, and process viruses that cause denial of service or thrashing within a system. And, I've tested for denial of services even against systems that supposedly aren't supposed to be vulnerable to these things, and almost every system can be caused to become unusable with this. Virus protection has been proven undecidable, and they're simple to write and very effective against most systems. Terrific. Yeah. Data diddling. Modification of data through unauthorized means. So, for example, non-database program manipulation of database files. It's fairly common in modern systems that the database program accesses the database files in one of two ways. Either there's a daemon process that runs privileged with access to the database files, and the database program calls the daemon program, or the database directly accesses the files, and the files are read-write by everybody that's able to access the database. That second case is the more common case. Everybody with authorized access to read and modify part of the database have access to the database files themselves. Now, the database might have some sort of a protection mechanism, but almost always, if you can get over to the command line or write your own program, you can go directly access the database files and modify anything you want or examine anything you want. I would, as a guesstimate of the, I'll say, of the 50 databases that I've looked at over the last 10 years in operating in real environments, all of them were susceptible to this. I mean, they don't have to be, but it's easier that way, easier to implement it and easier to break into. Modify configuration files used to set up further machines. You know, sometimes they, with remote management, they now manage one machine from another. So if you can manage to diddle the data on the controlling machine, it's much, much better. And in fact, in a number of cases, I've looked at systems, done an examination of a system, and found that all the programs were properly protected, but the data files that they read for their configuration information were not properly protected. So you diddle that data, and it blows up into privileged program, does what you want. Modification of data residing in temporary files, such as intermediate files created during a compilation. So compilers compile things in the temporary file area that's accessible to everybody. You modify one of those temporary files, and the compiled program now has the corrupt information. Or you examine it while it's being compiled, and you can read the, essentially the content of the program. Relatively simple task. If the data is writable, if it isn't writable, then you have to make it writable before you can write it. Van Eck bugging. Anybody ever actually find anybody doing Van Eck bugging in their environment? Do you know what Van Eck bugging is, Tom? You must. You found it. Oh, Zally. You've done it. Oh, great. Thank you. I'm not going to tell you guys who it is. I forgot. At the beginning of class, earlier we were joking around. Basically, the attendees of this class consist of foreign agents, federal, U.S. federal government employees in law enforcement and military and pseudo-military organizations. And I think there are like three people here from industry. So during the last part of the class, the spies sit over here, government agents over here, and that gives the spies the lead out the door. See? To know who we're chasing. You can all shake your hands, you know, and meet each other. Then you know who's going to catch you and throw you in jail. And then you guys know who to catch and throw in jail. Yeah, I mean, you know, look, just because we're going to be shooting at each other doesn't mean we can't be friends during my course. In Van Eck bugging, electromagnetic emanations are observed from afar. For example, you can, they did an example in the original publication of the paper by Van Eck in Computers and Security 10 or so years ago, where they tapped into Scotland Yard. They had a reporter, and they sat in a van outside New Scotland Yard and just watched the streams within the yard. And that was maybe 20 or 30 meters away. And there have been observed emanations from financial institutions indicative of pending trade. And like that, it's fairly easy to do. We're talking about $100 worth of stuff you can buy from Radio Shack. I guess probably now it's $250, and the old Radio Shack, they've changed a lot of the hardware, so you have to be a little bit more knowledgeable. It is against the law, by the way, in the United States. If you use a Van Eck device and you get caught, I think also in Canada, then you can get arrested. But, you know, people that break into systems don't care. So the legitimate people who use Van Eck devices. Wait a minute. What legitimate people use Vanex? It's not like so-called legitimate gun use. I'm not saying that there is no. I'm just saying that I can't think off the top of my head of any legitimate Vanex bugging use except for, you know, spying on people. Doesn't seem like whatever. So just to sort of give you a sense of this, maybe the best Vanex devices that I'm aware of. Can pick up emanations from a typical video terminal at maybe 500 meters at the outside. A kilometer's really pushing it. You need some very high-tech technology to get to a kilometer. And you need to be in the middle of a desert or something. 500 meters is awful tough in a complicated environment. In a city environment like San Francisco, maybe 100 meters or less. Off-the-shelf equipment and some expertise. Electronic interference. So you jam signals, and you do this to cause a failure in electronic communication systems. For example, there's a patent on the method and apparatus for altering a region in Earth atmosphere, ionosphere, and/or magnetosphere. This is a patent. Here's what it looks like. You sit up. somewhere in Alaska where the field lines of the Earth are, where they intersect the surface of the Earth, and you put a nuclear power plant up there, and you periodically, that is in the same period as the field lines change, you induce extra energy, creating positive feedback. Okay, and when you do that, you change the whole electromagnetic way the world works. Okay, now how severe is this? You know what? The let's see. I guess the published information says that we can take out all telecommunications, including inside your Ethernet, including inside your fiber optic network. We can take out all communications in a swath of Earth from the north to the south pole. Unfortunately, you can't really direct it very well, you know, towards Joe's house. But, you know, if you wanted to take out maybe the Midwest, no problem. Okay? If you move further over, you get South America, so you gotta be careful. But, you know, take out the Midwestern United States, no problem. You just take no communications. The only thing that will work is GWEN, which is Ground Wave Emergency Network. You know, ground wave, that's like they have a big hammer and they go boom. You know, they go dee 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 da 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 dee dee dee, and on the other coast you can hit that. All right, I got my 7 bits of message, you know. So this is a very, but very few people are likely to be able to exploit this, and, you know, probably if those people are coming after you, they're going to get you. So another one, but you can go to more common radio jamming techniques. And simplistic jamming is fairly straightforward, but power efficient jamming is necessary in order to have a good effect against things like spread spectrum and other anti-jamming systems. And so it's a fairly complicated, but it's all energy issues at that point. Herf guns? Yeah, I mean, it's an electronic jamming. Generally, electronic warfare techniques, offensive electronic warfare techniques, fall into jamming and some other similar things, although they're not strictly jamming. Some of them are strictly jamming, but there are other things that you do by inducing waves. PBX bugging. PBX, point branch exchange. The X comes from the middle of exchange because I guess phone people couldn't spell too well. PBX or similar switching centers are attacked to allow connected telephone instruments to be tapped. For example, we might be in a digital phone system, even though the receiver is on hook, we might be able to listen in to things on the microphone because the hook is simply a digital signal sent to the control center, as is the listening to the microphone. Okay. Similarly, the speakerphone feature might be enabled remotely without turning on the light because the light is a signal that says turn on light 5. The speaker listening to the speakerphone is another function entirely. So you can listen to the open microphone and silent conference calling exploitations. And so in cases where the functions support bugging are provided by the PBX, this attack is straightforward. And certainly the majority of PBXs have these features. You now get your 10:30 break. We will continue in 15 minutes at 10:45. Is there coffee outside?